Hello.
Hi, and welcome to Masked Murder, your true crime self-care podcast. We're your hostesses, Avery
and Nicole, and we're here to tell you about two things, masks and murder. Today, we'll dive into a true crime story, and then we'll follow it up with a little self-care session where we try out a new face mask and let you know what we think about it.
But before we dive into the story, we want to remind you that we are not psychologists or statisticians and have no medical background, so please don't take all of our comments as hard facts. We did our best to research the topics using Google and then coupling in our true crime obsession. This is what we came up with. And this week's story is about American singer, songwriter, and civil rights activist and entrepreneur Sam Cooke. He is commonly known as the King of Soul for his distinctive vocals and importance within popular music during the 50s and 60s. His murder is still highly debated and full of conspiracy theories. There are a lot of facts to the story, and to help you understand all of the twists and turns, let's start from the top. Samuel Cooke was born on January 22, 1931, in Clarksdale, Mississippi, which, to provide a little context, was in the middle of the Great Depression. His grandmother had been a slave, something that provided Sam with stories about the worst side of what Mississippi looked like back then. Sam was the fifth of eight children to Reverend Charles Cooke and his wife, Annie Mae. His family moved to Chicago in 1933, where his father worked as a minister. Sam attended Doolittle Elementary and Wendell Phillips Academy High School, which, fun fact, is the same school that Nat King Cole attended a few years earlier. Sam was immersed in music at a young age, attending and singing at his father's church. His career started at 6 years old, singing with his siblings in a group called The Singing Children. Very unique name. I love it. He first became known as lead singer with the Highway QCs when he joined the group at the age of 14. Having such a love for music throughout his life, Sam grew up wanting to start his own record label. In 1950, Sam replaced the lead singer of the gospel group The Soul Stirrers, who had signed with Specialty Records. Their first recording under Sam's leadership in both vocals and songwriting was the song Jesus Gave Me Water in 1951. This showed that he was not only a rising singer, but also an incredibly talented songwriter. Sam was often credited for bringing gospel music to the attention of a younger crowd of listeners, mainly females, who would rush the stage when the group came on. In 1953, Sam married singer-dancer Dolores Milligan, who took the stage name Dee Dee Mohawk. They would have one son named Joey.
I'm sorry, Dee Dee Mohawk. That is just so fun.
So good.
So fun. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just had to say it.
As his career continued to rise, touring and traveling around the country showed him exactly how awful Black people were being treated at the time. This insight sparked his need to help and change the situation. For example, he encountered many motels where they wouldn't let them stay and restaurants that they wouldn't actually let them in to eat. But Sam had found a couple of bright spots when he traveled. He loved rock and roll and Little Richie and frequently snuck out to different shows when he could. He really wanted to start singing rock music because it was so fun and lively. But he was hesitant because you could easily, you know, burn a bridge by switching to the AKA devil's music and alienate his gospel fan base. So he decided to dip his toes into the water without announcing it to the world necessarily. He came up with an alias. You'll never guess. It was Dale Cooke. Super different.
I mean,
no one will ever know.
No one will guess. Not related at all.
No. Under that name, he released his first pop soul song in 1956 called Lovable, a remake of the gospel song Wonderful. However, it fooled literally no one. Sam's unique and distinctive vocals were easily recognized and didn't take long for everyone to find out who it really was.
The head of Specialty Records, the label of the Soul Stirrers, that is a tongue twister.
Yeah, it's rough.
Gave his blessing for Sam to record secular music under his real name. But he was overall unhappy about the type of music he and his producer, Bumps Blackwell, were making. However, after an argument between the label and Bumps Blackwell, Sam left Specialty Records. And while Lovable was never exactly a hit, it didn't really flop either, which indicated Sam's future potential. Gospel music was pretty popular at the time, and Sam saw that his fans were mostly limited to low-income, rural parts of the country, and he wanted to branch out. He later admitted that he got an endorsement for a career in pop music from the least likely man, his father. Sam said, quote, "My father told me it was not what I sang that was important, but that God gave me a voice and musical talent, and the true use of his gift was to share it and make people happy." End quote.
Which is a super sweet sentiment.
It is.
If you're not into that type of music, I could definitely understand why he didn't want to tell his dad, but his dad was behind him, and I love that.
It's always great to have support at home.
For sure.
Yeah. So, with his father's blessing, Sam took the name Sam Cooke, simply adding an E to his original last name, and went out to seek a fresh start in pop music.
I do love the E. Like, why? Just a little flair?
I think just a little flair.
Yeah. Okay.
Why not?
People totally change their names all the time, but I haven't heard of many people being like, what if I just add an S or apostrophe or who knows? Just a little something-something.
Yeah. I don't know. But pretty quickly after his reintroduction in 1957, Sam appeared on ABC's The Guy Mitchell Show and signed with Keen Records. His first big hit, You Send Me, spent 6 weeks at number one on the Billboard R&B chart and 3 weeks at number one on the Billboard pop chart. It was a song that would dethrone the king, Elvis Presley, with his hit Jailhouse Rock as number one on the charts. Seeing how successful this artist could be, Dick Clark, the white host of the hit music and dance show American Bandstand, invited Sam to his show to sing his hit. This wasn't exactly mainstream at the time, and the KKK even... Yes, three of them. I was like, did I only say two? And the KKK threatened the show and Sam so that he wouldn't show up to play. Dick Clark didn't back down and decided to call on the National Guard to protect the studio. And Sam wasn't scared either and showed up as scheduled to sing on the show. He wanted to prove that he could do it and that he wasn't afraid of the KKK. Throughout his career, Sam was a lady killer, often meeting women out on tour. And in 1958, Dolores and Sam finalized their divorce.
Well, with that point, I really can't imagine why.
I mean, infidelity? Meh. For the birds.
For the birds.
Not for the birds. God, fucking conversation from last week. Oh, gosh. Anyway, later that same year, Sam married his second wife, Barbara Campbell, in Chicago, where his father performed the ceremony. And do you know if his father performed his first ceremony?
So you would think he would, right? But I couldn't find anything that said he actually did. I assume, because it was called out in the second and not the first, that either the fact that he kind of like blessed the second marriage was what was so atypical, or the fact that it didn't actually occur. So he didn't actually oversee? What is it? Like he didn't actually perform the ceremony for the first one. So in short, no idea.
All right. Fair enough. But Sam and Barbara had three children together, which might actually be a prime example of why Sam and his first wife, Dolores, divorced. Sam and Barbara's first child, Linda, was born in 1953, the same year that he and Dolores got married.
Dun, dun, dun.
Their second child, Tracy, was born in 1960, and their youngest, Vincent, was born in 1961. Which, it seems like 1961 was actually a very good year for Sam, since his lifelong dream came true and he started his own record label. I don't know if it's S-A-R or SAR, but every time I read it, I want to say SARS, like the disease.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think it's S-A-R, but it does look like, well, actually it is. It's SAR, so it looks like SARS.
Yeah, so the meaning of S-A-R has actually been kind of disputed. It's been listed as standing for Sam and Alex Records. J.W. Alexander was Sam's business and songwriting associate, as well as a longtime friend. But it's also been listed as standing for Sam, Alex, and Roy Records. Alex being the same J.W. Alexander, and then Roy being S.R. Crane, Sam's mentor from his Soul Stirrers days, as well as his pop road manager. And Sam also went on to establish a publishing imprint and management firm named CAGS, which was named for a friend's eccentric stepfather.
So many fun facts.
I know.
But also CAGS, like, what a CAGS. Good name. I mean, yeah. Do you think it's his given name or a nickname?
Oh, it's got to be a nickname.
Right?
Which makes you wonder, like, how it came about.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, what could it possibly mean?
Yeah. I also saw that he had another record label called Derby, but I couldn't find anything else about that. So,
oh, I missed that one. Interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe that one flopped, perhaps. Like, maybe it didn't have funding or something. Who knows?
But beats me.
All right. So on that note, Sam said he started these companies to help promote Black artists and wasn't afraid if he lost money in it overall because it was worth it just to simply help his brothers.
What about his sisters?
Well, both, but the quote was brothers. Sam's rise to stardom meant that he didn't have to travel for shows much anymore. He could easily have stuck to a few big venues and brought in huge crowds and made plenty of money. With the unruly nature of the era, it was really dangerous for a black man to travel so widely, but it was really important to Sam to show up in the South. He wanted to remain present and reachable for all people. Sam was incredibly moved by the stories of Emmett Till and Jesse Belvin. They were two of the reasons that really ignited the fire within Sam to fight racism. In case those names don't sound familiar, Emmett Till was the 14-year-old African-American boy who was lynched in Mississippi in 1955 after being accused of offending a white woman in her family's grocery store.
For simply offending her? And at the age of 14?
Yeah. So I've heard about this. Obviously, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement has sparked up a lot of these stories to kind of come to light again. I've heard of it in the past, and I always knew it as something really simple. Like, he flirted with the girl when he was checking out, or I think I even read a report at some point that he, like, touched her hand. But when I was actually getting the facts for this story, it mentioned that her report to the police was that he, like, came on to her and basically alluded to them having sex, which seems a little crass for a 14-year-old in general. Like, I kind of feel like that's not likely. I guess 14 was very different then.
Well, anyways. Back then, at 14, I can't really see it. Today at 14, I definitely can. Because kids these days are just, no.
Well, hopefully none of this ever happens, but that is a very prominent story. And that one I actually do know. But the other one, Jesse Belvin, was an American rock and roll singer, pianist, and songwriter popular in the 50s. On February 6, 1960, after finishing a performance with Sam in Arkansas, he and his wife died in a head-on collision. It was later learned that his tires had actually been cut, which caused the head-on crash. He was only 27.
Ugh, I hate people. Talk about a hate crime.
I know, it's awful. I can't imagine that knowing that, especially the fact that, like, he literally left you. He was there for, like, because of you. Yeah. Or, I guess, to be, like, around you, sing with you. Yeah. Like, it would just really mess up anybody.
Yeah. Survivor's guilt.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Good.
I was just going to say, although I feel like you would have that more if you were had been supposed to be in the car with them.
Oh, God. Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, ultimate survivor's guilt. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway.
At this time, concert halls weren't exactly segregated, but had white and black people separated. Some venues raised the price for black guests, others having black guests farther from the stage, not able to dance, or actually vice versa. I read a couple that all the, like, white people were up top looking down on the black people. It was a lot of gross stories.
Symbolism.
Yeah. Or even having them just separated on either side of the aisle.
Which, I don't know. To me, that sounds like segregation, like, not in the same, I don't know.
Oh, I mean, to be honest, I don't have a huge background on segregation laws, but that makes me think more of, like, there was probably a black venue and a white venue as segregation, but I guess blacks and whites went to school together, so you just had, like, separate water fountains. I'm not real sure, but regardless, it's fucked up. So Sam thought so, too. He actually took a public stance that he wouldn't play in segregated spaces moving forward, which was a huge deal because musicians' music could be banned due to any controversial political stances. Sam decided he also wanted to represent some of the more natural states of African Americans. He did this by being one of the first people to start wearing his hair in a natural state. You know, an afro.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this part makes me laugh. According to his friends, his mama, quote-unquote, almost fell out of her chair when she saw it. Because at the time, black men were supposed to have highly processed hair, and she wasn't really sure about the natural look.
So I'm assuming this is so that they could try to be more like white men?
Absolutely.
You just said that so quickly.
Abso-fucking-lutely.
Cool. Eye roll.
Yeah, massive. We all have to conform. But actually, I was really far from the microphone. But actually, have you, or can you think of any of the, like, old school 50s, 60s images for, like, records at the time? And they all had, like, that sleek back, shiny hair. Yeah, that stuff. Wasn't good look then. Like, no one likes that.
Yeah.
But anyways, good for Sam. In 1963, Sam signed a 5-year contract with Alan Klein to manage CAG's music and SAR Records and made him his new manager. Klein was able to negotiate a 5-year deal with RCA Victor. In this deal, a holding company, Tracy Limited, which was named after Sam's daughter, owned by Klein and managed by J.W. Alexander, would produce and own Sam's recordings. That same year, his 18-month-old son, Vincent, slipped into their pool while his mother went inside for a quick moment. Sadly, he did not survive the incident. To make matters worse, the pool was in the front yard of their home, meaning that they literally couldn't walk into their house without seeing the place that brought back so many painful memories. This obviously would be a huge reminder of the tragedy, which can trigger the grief process to start all over again. With it being their home, the only real options are to understand and kind of be prepared of the constant reminder or move, which isn't exactly easy. Of course, getting to the place where you can start to be logical about your grief is unlikely to be quick, and something you really have to work towards. According to the Mayo Clinic, some tips to cope with reawakened grief are be prepared. Just knowing that you're likely to experience a reaction and kind of understanding your feelings beforehand will really help and actually open up opportunities for healing. You can plan a distraction, schedule something with your friends or loved ones during times that you're likely to feel alone or reminded of your loss. This recommendation is obviously a little bit more for long-term grief. So if you know an anniversary is coming up or something, not an everyday situation. You can also reminisce about the relationship. Take the reminder as a time to focus on the good things that you had together rather than the loss itself. You could start a new tradition. Make a donation to a charitable organization in your loved one's name or plant a tree in their honor. You can connect with others. Draw friends and family close to you. Stay connected to your usual support systems and don't be afraid to join a support group if you need it. And allow yourself just to feel all of the emotions. It's okay to be sad and feel a sense of loss, but also allow yourself to experience joy and happiness. You need it all to be able to move forward. But on top of that, the loss really affected his marriage and led him to spending more time away from home than ever, which means more tours and more women.
Now, we do want to take just a second here to talk about how the loss of a child can affect a marriage. One of the most common beliefs is that after the death of a child, the majority of marriages end in divorce. But facts actually show that the death of a child usually acts as a way to polarize the existing factors found within the marriage. Meaning, some marriages get worse, some get better, some simply maintain, and some actually do end in divorce. 4 major issues that grieving couples repeatedly reported resulting from the death of their child are sexual problems, emotional distancing, more conflict or fighting, and if the child was the glue that kind of held the marriage together, they now have to find a new foundation. Now, all that being said, and getting back to the story, there was a time that Sam found himself stuck at home with the flu and decided to read through some of his company's paperwork. You know, a little admin work that he didn't have time for when he was out on the road. Well, when he was reading these papers, he found that Alan Klein worked the contracts for the recording label so that he really owned the company and Sam was merely an employee.
What an awful thing to stumble upon.
Yes, but I also feel like it's better to find it out ahead of any problems than to, like, go to do something and then find out, well, you don't own this company.
Yeah. Well, it's just any of those stories. What I'm really thinking is I just was watching Schitt's Creek and, you know, people, like, stealing your money. You put all this trust in someone to find out that they're, like, actually just screwing you over.
I haven't seen Schitt's Creek yet, so.
Oh, I mean, that's, like, the opener. That's the basis of the show, so I didn't just spoil anything.
No, I know. I lost my spot. So, obviously, Sam was shocked and upset, but he knew that he was going to have to find a way to change this. And around the same time, the civil rights anthem, Blowin' in the Wind, by Bob Dylan, hit the radio. It inspired Sam to sing similar songs around racial justice. Racial injustice.
Well, I guess it could be both. The movement would be for racial justice. Problems. Yeah, race problems.
He thought that if this guy could share his message, then so could Sam. And making records just wasn't cutting it. It wasn't making him feel fulfilled anymore. He wanted to be in the center of the fight against racial change and to really make a difference. So he surrounded himself with other men that had what they called unstoppable black male energy, which I just love.
Oh, it's so good.
Now, two of these friends were Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali.
Casual.
Yeah, you know, no big. Their friendship was seen as a huge threat to the white side of the movement. And on February 25th, 1964, Cassius Clay, soon to be known as Muhammad Ali, shocked the world by winning the heavyweight championship of the world title in Miami. The triumph was so unexpected that no post-fight event was planned. That was such a tongue twister, and yeah. I don't know why. Clay, a.k.a. Ali, was left to celebrate in a decidedly low-key fashion at his Miami hotel with three friends, controversial religious leader Malcolm X, singer Sam Cooke, and NFL star Jim Brown. That night became a historic summit of four men who would become prominent figures in the civil rights movement. It even inspired the play One Night in Miami that was first performed in 2013.
In 1964, Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali were being watched by the FBI due to their potential to cause a movement or an uprising of sorts. Now, RCA didn't like that Sam was hanging out with them because it meant that he could possibly lose favor with the white crowd and, let's be real, lose them money. To combat this, they simply deleted some specific verses of songs that were, quote-unquote, too political. It was also reported that around this time, the mob tried to get into his recording business by threatening Sam. Everything I read said his general response was that he didn't care and wasn't scared of them. On December 10th, 1964, Sam was out to dinner at Martoni's Italian restaurant with a couple of friends. Remember when we used to go to restaurants?
No.
Good old days, man.
Or bars.
Just public with what's people.
Yeah.
Anywho, not anyone's problem in 1964. The 33-year-old R&B singer had recently released a Live at the Copa album, which was climbing the charts and was on the brink of stepping up to the big leagues on par with Nat King Cole and Sammy Davis Jr. Basically, a long way of saying that everyone noticed him being in the restaurant. Well-wishers kept stopping by to the table and interrupting their conversation. Sam, who'd had maybe three or four martinis at this point, was eventually pulled away to the bar. When the dinners arrived, his friend went to get Sam from the bar and found him laughing it up with a group of friends and fellow music business associates. And Sam was fine, so I'd stick around too. He had flashed a wad of bills, which looked like maybe thousands of dollars. His friend told him not to show that to everyone, but Sam acted like who would dare take money from him? He was untouchable, right?
Bold move. Bad assumption. Always a bad assumption. No one's untouchable. Like, not even Jesus.
No one. He told his friends that they should just go ahead with their meal and he would be along later. At a booth near the bar, there was a baby-faced 22-year-old Asian girl sitting with three guys. Sam, of course, had caught her eye. One of the guys sitting with her was a guitar player that Sam knew and introduced them. The girl's name was Elisa Boyer. Before long, the pair was cozied up in a booth. They left Martoni's around 1 a.m. in Sam's brand new red Ferrari and headed to a nightclub called PJ's, where they were going to meet up with some of Sam's friends. By the time they arrived, his friends were already gone, and Sam and Elisa got back into the car and left. Later that evening, a call was made to police from the Hacienda Motel by a woman saying that she had been kidnapped. Around that same time, police received another call about a shooting. They responded to the Hacienda Motel in L.A. Here, they found Sam Cooke had been shot. He had sustained a gunshot wound to the chest, which was later determined to have pierced his heart. The motel's manager, Bertha Franklin, claimed to have shot him in self-defense. Her account was immediately disputed by Sam's acquaintances. He just simply wasn't that type of guy. Elisa's story to police was that after they left the local nightclub together, she had repeatedly requested that he take her home. Instead, he took her against her will to the Hacienda Motel. She said that once they were in one of the motel rooms, he physically forced her onto the bed and stripped her down to her panties, at which point she was sure he was going to rape her. She then quickly convinced him to let her use the bathroom, from which she attempted to escape but found that the window was firmly shut, which I'm going to call bullshit on. He was, like, quote-unquote, going to rape you, and you're like, excuse me, can I go to the bathroom? Can we pause this potential rape?
He's not going to say yes.
Yeah.
No, that's not how that works.
Sounds much more casual. I mean, they had obviously been drinking, so maybe foggy memories, to put it nicely, but I don't believe her.
Me neither.
According to Elisa, she returned to the main room where Sam continued his groping. When he went to use the bathroom, she grabbed her clothes and ran from the room. She said that in her haste, she had scooped up most of Sam's clothing by mistake. Elisa said she ran to the manager's office first and knocked on the door seeking help. However, the manager was taking too long to respond, so fearing Sam would soon be after her, she fled the motel before the manager was able to open the door. She said that she then put her clothing back on, hid Sam's clothing, and went to a telephone booth to call the police.
The motel manager, Bertha, told police that Sam came banging on the door of her office, shouting, "Where's the girl?" I don't know why I found myself so funny. She shouted back that there was no one in her office except for herself, but the enraged Sam didn't believe her and forced his way into the office, naked, except for one shoe and a sport jacket, which just gives you the best mental picture, does it not?
Absolutely. I don't understand how you're even just wearing a sports jacket and one shoe. Like, in what reality are you wearing just one shoe? You take them both off. If he was in the bathroom, was he putting one shoe back on? Like, doubt it.
Yeah, it's strange.
Beyond
me. Bertha reports that he violently grabbed her and demanded again to know where the woman was. But she said that she fought with him and told police that he fell on top of her and she tried to bite him through the jacket, biting, scratching, and everything. She said she finally got up and kicked him. And then she said, "I run and grabbed the pistol off the TV and I shot at close range 3 times. She said that she fired at him in self-defense because she feared for her life. 2 of the bullets missed, but the 3rd entered his left side, passed through his left lung, his heart, and through his left, right lung. Left, right, left. Left, center, right.
Regardless, I feel like that's some pretty good aim. That's all of the organs. You just, she touched
all the major
all.
Ones.
Mm-hmm.
And according to Bertha, he exclaimed, "Lady, you shot me," in a tone that expressed perplexity, not anger, before making a final charge at her.
Well, all of that just makes sense. That's how you would react if you got shot, right? "Excuse me, ma'am. Can you please confirm that you shot me? With that, I die." Anyways.
You're not dramatic. Bertha said that she then beat him over his head with a broomstick before he finally fell, mortally wounded by the gunshot. And can I just say, I have all the questions. Were the other 2 shots confirmed? Like, they had to go into something if they didn't go into him, right?
Yeah, I feel like I saw something that they were found in the wall, but don't hold me to that.
Okay. And then, like, what about her claims about biting and scratching him? Were there defensive wounds? Did he have scratches? Did she have scratches? Did she have his skin under his nails?
Yeah.
Her nails?
I get what you mean. I didn't see any reports to those details, but it really would help to corroborate the story that she had put in place. So you'd think they looked into that at least. But I don't think we know.
I don't know. But what we do know is that the motel's owner, Evelyn Carr, corroborated Bertha's story and said that she had been on the phone with Bertha at the time of the incident. She said she overheard the intrusion and the ensuing conflict, as well as the gunshot. She had even been the one to call police to request that officers go to the motel, telling them she believed a shooting had occurred. A coroner's inquest was convened to investigate the incident. The woman who had accompanied Sam to the motel was identified by police as Elisa Boyer, who had also called the police from a nearby telephone booth that night, several minutes before the owner had. Elisa's story is the only account of what happened between her and Sam that night, since, you know, he's dead. And her story has actually long been called into question. Inconsistencies between her version of events and details reported by diners at Martoni's restaurant, where Sam dined and drank earlier in the evening, suggest that Elisa may have gone willingly to the motel with Sam and then slipped out of the room with his clothing to rob him rather than to escape an attempted rape. Remember how Sam had been carrying a large amount of money and flaunting it around at dinner?
Yeah, of course I do. A pretty unusual detail.
Right? But in a search of Elisa's purse by police revealed nothing except for a $20 bill, and a search of Sam's Ferrari found only a money clip with $108 and a few loose coins.
Okay. So with all of that, my bet is that she had someone outside waiting for her and she maybe passed the money off.
And then made the call to set him up, obviously. And I don't know about you, but are you thinking that maybe the hotel manager was in on it and that they paid off the owner?
I mean, yeah. Yeah. I think I'm buying into the larger conspiracy theory on this.
There's got to be a movie about this, right?
Well, there is a documentary.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Tell us about it later. But in the meantime, Elisa. Sorry, I can't. Elisa testified that she met Sam at a Hollywood dinner party and that he sang a song at the party, but she made no mention of Martoni's or PJ's, which is super sketchy since so many people had seen her there and one of her and Sam's mutual friends had introduced them. She said that she was kidnapped by Sam and couldn't escape because his car was going too fast. Yet when Sam went into the motel to register, Elisa was left alone in the car. She could have escaped or yelled for help. And even more confusing, if it was Sam's intention to rape Elisa, why would he have registered under his own name?
Solid points. I agree. Makes, like that.
Makes no sense. Elisa's story was that she mistakenly took Sam's clothes from the room when she grabbed her own, but wouldn't it make sense that she was merely trying to prevent his pursuit so that he wouldn't follow after her naked?
Mm-hmm.
And what about the wad of cash that she spied early in the night? She had to have known exactly where he was keeping it.
Oh, yeah. That's not something you just forget.
No. Then on January 11th, 1965, 1 month to the day after Sam's death, Elisa was arrested for prostitution when a man offered her $40 for sex, only to promptly show her a badge when she accepted. The charges were later dismissed after it was determined to be a case of entrapment.
Even though the charges were dropped on that, questions about her role in Sam Cook's death increased. Elisa's leaving the motel room with almost all of Sam's clothing, and the fact that tests showed Sam was inebriated at the time provides a plausible explanation to the inquest jurors for his bizarre behavior and state of undress. Also, because the motel owner's testimony corroborated Bertha's version of events, and because both Elisa and Bertha later passed polygraph test. The coroner's jury ultimately accepted Bertha's explanation and returned a verdict of justifiable homicide. With that verdict, authorities officially closed the case on Sam Cook's death. Some of Sam's friends and family have rejected Elisa's version of events, as well as those given at the motel. They believe that there was a conspiracy to murder Sam, and that the murder took place in some manner entirely different from those three official witnesses. Singer Etta James viewed Sam's body before his funeral and questioned the accuracy of the official version of events. She wrote that the injuries she observed were well beyond the official account of Sam having fought Bertha alone, and that he was so badly beaten, his head was nearly separated from his shoulders, his hands were broken and crushed, and his nose mangled.
I mean, those don't exactly sound like injuries that would come from a broomstick. Unless maybe the broom was attached to, I don't know, like a tire iron?
Oh, agreed. I don't think that aligns to the story at all, and seems like a reason to perhaps not just close the case and agree with what all of the witnesses are saying.
Right.
But I guess I wasn't there. I'm not in charge. Some people have speculated that Sam's manager, Alan Klein, might have had a role in his death. Alan owned Tracy Limited, which ultimately owned all the rights to Sam's recordings. Remember how Sam realized shortly before he died how Alan had put the companies in his favor and how he was going to go out and seek to change that?
We do. And did you see any evidence that Sam ever confronted Alan with this little fact?
No, I didn't actually see anything about it. My assumption is that he was probably trying to slow play it because, you probably have to get your house in order, right? You go to seek legal counsel, you figure out what you can do. And in my mind, at least, it's easier to kind of control the situation from within. If he had told Alan and Alan decided just to cut ties with him and fire him, it's harder to control that from outside.
Fair.
Yeah. But Sam's death did solidify the ability for Alan to fully own all of the businesses, so I do think that's a pretty clear motive. Sam's first funeral service was held on December 18th, 1964, in Chicago. 200,000 fans lined up for more than four city blocks to view his body. Afterward, his body was flown back to LA for a second service on December 19th, which included a much-heralded performance of The Angels Keep Watching Over Me by Ray Charles, who had actually stood in for the grief-stricken Bessie Griffin. Which, I mean, Ray Charles is your backup? Like, okay.
I'm sure you got some pipes on your girl.
Mm-hmm. I see you, Bessie. Sam was finally laid to rest at Forest Lawn Memorial Park Cemetery in Glendale, California. There wasn't a complete investigation done because Sam, quote-unquote, was just another black guy killed in L.A.
Which is disgusting.
Oh, it's awful. But... And it was the time. Still kind of is the time. Sam was a target for a lot of reasons, but one huge one was he was an original advocate for Black Lives Matter. You know, obviously years before this movement even existed. Now, was the FBI possibly involved in his murder? Was he maybe getting too big and holding too much power to change the racial divide? Who knows? But something interesting is that Change Is Gonna Come was the last song Sam ever released, and is still incredibly relevant today. It is considered a classic protest song from the era of the civil rights movement. Muhammad Ali was quoted saying that if Sam Cooke had been Frank Sinatra, quote, the FBI would have been involved in solving the case.
And Bertha Franklin, who was an ex-madam with her own criminal record, said she received numerous death threats after the shooting. She left her position at the Hacienda Motel and did not publicly disclose where she had moved. After being cleared by the coroner's jury, she sued Sam's estate, citing physical injuries and mental anguish suffered as a result of the attack. Her lawsuit sought $200,000 in compensation and punitive damages. Barbara countersued Bertha on behalf of the estate, seeking $7,000 in damages to cover the funeral expenses. Elisa Boyer provided testimony in support of Bertha in the case. In 1967, a jury ruled in favor of Bertha on both counts, awarding her $30,000 in damages. It was later revealed that Bertha Franklin had moved to Michigan, but never disclosed what her new career was. She died of coronary artery disease in 1989. Elisa Boyer was once again arrested in 1979 after a fight with a boyfriend, where he ended up dead.
Yeah, that's slightly sketchy, maybe?
Slightly sketchy.
Yeah.
And while we weren't able to find anything about how he died, we did find that she was found guilty of second-degree murder and sentenced to 25 years to life imprisonment.
Yeah, so must have been pretty brutal.
Had to have been, right?
Well, I guess he died, so yeah.
Her conviction reignited interest in the Sam Cooke case and gave fuel to conspiracy theorists about the 1964 death. As for Barbara Cooke, Sam's second wife, her husband's infidelity was nothing new to her. She also had a little action going on the side with a local bartender. And on the day of Sam's funeral, this bartender was seen wearing Sam's watch and his ring.
Okay, I was about to say, like, get it, girl, for getting a little something on the side when she obviously knew that her husband was, but seems a little awful that she immediately gave him Sam's belongings at all.
Very cold. Very cold-hearted. So, don't get it, girl. 2 months after Sam's death, Barbara dumped the bartender and went on to marry Sam's friend and backup singer, Bobby Womack. To make this point even crazier, apparently Sam's daughter, Linda, later had an affair with Bobby. But she did end up marrying his brother, Cecil Womack, and they became the duo Womack and Womack.
But I think that little nugget of information is, like, the most scandalous, unnecessary piece to the story, but so interesting. Like, what? So dramatic.
Yes.
For Sam's part, he was always a womanizer. As his friend Bumps Blackwell once said, quote, Sam would walk past a good girl to get to a whore. Which, I mean, wow. Your friend, I guess, really knows you. But anywho, there are all kinds of theories around his death. A drug deal involving someone close to Sam in which Sam perhaps tried to intervene, a mafia hit, a setup devised by a jealous Barbara Cooke, or a hostile takeover by his partner, Alan Klein. Many believe it was a racial plot in the entertainment business. As with any rising star, not to mention one of color in the early 60s, Sam had made a couple of enemies. As one friend of his said, he, quote, he was just getting too big for his britches for a suntanned man, which I don't think I've heard the suntanned man thing, but I like it.
No, but I've heard too big for your britches.
Too big for your britches, for sure. All right, anyhow, was Sam Cooke perhaps lured into a trap at the Hacienda Motel? Were Elisa Boyer and Bertha Franklin working in tandem? Was Barbara Cooke somehow involved? Or was it all just a tragic accident? Over the years, investigators have made noises about possibly reopening the case, but with most of the principal players dead and gone, it's unlikely it will ever be solved. At this point, no concrete evidence supporting a criminal conspiracy has been presented. If you want to learn more about this, there is a really interesting Netflix documentary that you can watch called Remastered, The Two Killings of Sam Cooke. But I think that's enough of that. Let's get on to the self-care portion of our evening, shall we?
Yes, please.
All right, and we're back. And Nicole, what mask are we trying this week?
Tonight we're doing Unmask Beauty's Mask Bar Rose Gold Foil Peel-Off Mask. And I obviously picked this one out because of the rose gold metallic factor, and the color did not disappoint.
I mean, I'm just impressed you picked one that's a peel-off.
Well, I actually thought it was a sheet mask, I'm not going to lie.
Oh, so surprise.
It was a surprise peel-off. But so we'll see how this one goes.
We misted our faces in advance, so hopefully it comes off nice and smooth for you.
We did. And so the Mask Bar website describes this as a metallic peel-off mask that clarifies, smooths, and moisturizes the skin. It's infused with raspberry fruit extract, macadamia, ternifolia seed oil, and grapefruit extract, which the raspberry fruit extract is high in antioxidants and vitamin C. The macadamia ternifolia seed oil, God, I hope I'm saying that right, is the balancing sebum production in oily skin and creates a natural protective barrier over the skin. And the grapefruit extract promotes smoother skin by increasing the rate of cell renewal.
Very fancy. Okay.
Yes. And it is designed, they say that it's good to be used with all skin types, so literally anyone can try it.
That's good. A mask for everyone.
A mask for everyone. It's supposed to instantly detoxify the skin, make your pores look smaller, improve your skin complexion, and leave your skin looking glowing and bright.
I need all of those things, so cool.
Great.
And then just a quick note on how you actually put it on. You're supposed to do a thin layer of the peel-off mask onto clean skin, of course. Perhaps slightly moisturized skin so it doesn't adhere too much because, as Nicole knows, sometimes you need a little extra moisture so it actually peels. This one stays on for 10 to 15 minutes until the mask is completely dry. And oh, also one note that we both realized when we were putting this on, there was actually extra of the mask, which is not normal.
Yeah, we got one of the sample size ones. It is also available in a full tube if you are interested.
Yeah, well, let's see. And then to take it off, you gently peel off the mask in a downward motion from the outer edges and rinse with warm water or facial toner, which I think I'm going to go toner route. I like that.
All right.
But we'll see. We've already put our mask on in advance of this, so we can get down to it. And we started a timer we went in the middle, 12 minutes. So since we've already been talking, we're down to 8. So
woot.
Let's get to our fun conversation for this week.
Yes.
And Nicole has some, yet again, exciting news.
I'm really just trying to grab 2020 by the balls and tell it to go fuck itself.
Do it. Fill it with love.
So I adopted a puppy on Friday. She is an adorable 1.5-year-old hound mix, and she came with the name Minnie.
Frickin' fate.
Yes.
Has to be.
Anyone that knows me knows that I'm obsessed with Disney, so obviously I'm letting her keep her shelter name, because why wouldn't I?
Oh, yeah.
It's just perfect.
I'm actually kind of surprised we didn't think about Minnie as a name when we were just talking about it.
Yeah.
Like, it seems almost too obvious to have been brought up, but
I feel like that's why I was kind of geared away from it, is because it was too, like, obvious. And I was like, well, I mean, you know, whatever, but it works.
Yeah, I love it. And she's the sweetest dog. I met her the other night.
Yes, she's so sweet and so calm and loving and, like, adorable in the condo. but she is one big mouth handful when we're taking walks.
Well, so she's a pretty decent sized dog. Do you know what her weight is?
47 pounds was her last weigh in.
Okay.
So she should be about a 50 pounder.
Okay. So she's a healthy sized dog of, would you call her a medium sized dog? Or is she like a small large? I don't know.
I'd say she's a medium. A medium.
Okay.
Medium. I'd say medium.
Overall, she's strong. That's what I was trying to allude to.
Yeah. She also has, she's got the muscle and she's very playful and energetic like a puppy because she is a puppy.
Yeah. What, 1.5?
1.5, yeah. Still a puppy.
Totally a puppy. Puppy years are like the first 4, so.
Yeah. So we're still working on the leash training and hopefully I'll have a trainer hired soon that can help me out with that.
Yeah. Yes, it is much harder with a big dog that can actually like pull you.
Versus one you can just pick up.
Mm-hmm. My little one, I'm just like, stop it. And then it's over. And then she, you know, calms down. But yours, whole different situation.
Oh my God. And it's just walking. She sees anything walk by and she just is immediately barking and like trying to go see that person or that other dog or anything. And she's got this deep, terrifying bark, which I'm actually like kind of proud of. Because one of my things was like, I want a dog that like looks friendly, but like if you mess with me, you're going to.
Yeah. Yeah. I think she's already living up to that.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's where we're adjusting to each other's lives.
Well, she already seems right at home.
She is. She follows me around and she just snuggles and play. I got out of the shower today and she was just laying on the mat underneath of the bathtub. And I was like, I'm supposed to step there. You're in the way.
I mean, you can't blame her. It's a nice little spot for her to lay, but also still be really close to you.
Yeah, I'm just glad that she wasn't like, because I haven't moved that shoe rack of mine. So, like, I'm just really glad that she wasn't, like, in there chewing up, like, my high heels that I wear to work quite often or my flats that I wear almost every day. Like,
yeah. Yeah, let's not have that go down.
Yeah. No. I'm happy with her in-house progress, and hopefully the out-of-the-house progress will.
Yeah. The training just takes time. She's still getting acclimated to a new place, to a new person.
Yeah.
But she seems very, like, into you. So I think the new person part's probably already done. Box checked. Bridge. Yeah.
Yeah. The one thing that I'm really nervous about, so I booked her first vet appointment for Wednesday night.
Yeah.
And the, like, shelter notes said that she was really nervous and kind of aggressive during her initial exam there. And she had to be muzzled, so I need to go out and get a muzzle for her for when I take her to the vet. And I'm not going to be happy about putting that on her.
Well, you let them put it on her. I don't know. I mean, I guess from what you've experienced with, like, her walking around and barking at everyone, going to a confined space with a lot of other people and a lot of other dogs.
Yeah, so the way that I read that they want you to do it now is they want you to, like, you call when you get there and then they'll, like, come out for your appointment. So I won't be, like, in a waiting area, which is good.
Right. COVID rules. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course.
So it's actually kind of better. But, like, do I wait until we get there to put it on her? We're in the car? Like, I don't
know.
I wait until they're like, all right, we're coming out. And I'm like, okay, give me a minute. I got to like try to put this muzzle on her. I don't know how it's going to go.
Yeah. Well, ask them. I'm sure they have like a best practice for that.
Okay. Good idea.
Yeah.
Good call.
I mean, you have no idea what circumstances she went the first time. Maybe the person taking her was awful to her. Maybe she got done playing and then they took her or like, who knows what.
No idea. That's my big news.
The biggest news. You got a new little snuggle bug.
Oh, she's so sweet.
And my favorite thing is, I mean, like we mentioned before, she's not a little dog, but she will sit on you.
She thinks she's a little dog.
Yeah, she thinks she's a lap dog.
Mm-hmm.
And she's adorable.
Oh my God, trying to put my shoes on. I'm like, if you get off me, I can put them on faster and then we can go out sooner.
Nah.
Back off.
I'm just going to get right in your way.
Yeah. No, she's the sweetest little angel and I'm lucky work is being really, like, understanding and, like, lenient with me coming in and, like, working from home this week. So she can get adjusted.
Oh, they're going to let you work from home. Oh, great.
Yeah. So I don't really need to take any of my, like, leave, which is nice.
Oh, yeah.
Big bonus.
Oh, and you've already figured out what treats work well for her?
That was a pain. But no, she loves hot dogs.
I mean, all-American girl right there.
Yeah. I might also, like, Somebody mentioned like boiling chicken.
Oh, yeah.
So I might, because I got some chicken when I was at the store getting food for myself because she had food. And I was like, well, I'm going to get some hot dogs, see if she likes those. Luckily, she does because they were buy one, get one free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no.
She's burning through them, dude.
Oh, I'm sure. One, she can eat a lot.
Well, she's really not eating a lot of her actual food.
Oh, well, that's a whole nother thing. Is she not eating her food because she knows that she's about to get some hot dogs?
Well, the hot dogs just started, though.
Oh.
Before that, she wasn't. I feel like she's just adjusting to...
Just getting used to things.
Yeah. Going to give her a couple weeks. Mm-hmm. So, see how she settles. I'm sure it'll go fine.
Oh, she'll be lovely.
Yes.
But you're crating her at night.
I have the past two nights. Mm-hmm. I'm playing with the idea of not tonight, but...
It's gonna chance it.
I might. Because literally, we go back after walks in the morning and in the afternoon, and we just kind of hang out. She just kind of follows me around or lays down with me.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that she would if she did get up in the middle of the night to try and go pee on something, unless it's on the bed, I would notice.
Yeah, just definitely close your door. Decrease the chances of her getting into anything anywhere. She's not supposed to.
Yeah.
Or, maybe getting up in the middle of the night and, drinking a bunch of water, which then could prevent her, peeing on the ground or something.
Yeah, I could probably, pick up her water bottle. Water bottle. She got a water bottle. She's fancy and picks up her water bottle, drinks out of it, and then puts it away.
Her glass water bottle that's organically sourced, locally owned.
No, her... It is a glass dish, though. Well, because... They recommend.
Because she fancy.
Well, yeah. They recommend glass or metal because they're easier to clean and don't, hold the bacteria like plastic ones do.
Yeah, yeah. Solid points. I mean, that's what I prefer for myself.
Yep. Ooh.
Timer.
Ooh. Are you feeling like you're...
I feel taut. I think it's dry. I don't feel any wet spots. Touch.
I've got a couple of, tacky spots.
Okay. All right, we can minutes. Wait... A little bit, but I don't want to leave it on too long because that actually might be a mask you don't want to leave on longer than you are supposed to.
Yeah, I think I did see that it has a bit of alcohol-based ingredients, which will dry out your skin.
Right, and we all know I don't need help with that, so.
No, you don't. Have you gotten any house projects or anything done recently that you want to talk about?
I finished painting the tile in our bathroom. Which is nice. Ran out of paint, so technically I would have done slightly more. But we have to get paint for the floor anyway, so if I get more white, I can touch up any spots. But I can live with it the way it is. It is fine. It is a huge difference, and I'm very happy that I kind of found a way to keep the original tile in the house, at least for now. I'm sure one day we'll want to remodel the bathroom, but right now, not my focus. I'm just trying to make it... Nicer.
Make it your own.
More livable, yeah. Something that reflects what I like instead of just the house I'm in kind of thing.
Fair enough. I feel like your space should always feel like your space.
Yeah.
So.
I think my biggest challenge I've realized is window coverings, drapes and such. It's a lot for me to decide what I want. For some reason, I feel like that's really a big decision. But I'm not worried about painting anything.
Painting is kind of a bigger deal. It takes more effort.
Logically,
to change.
I hear you. I get it. But I have been much quicker to paint the tile, the walls, whatever it is, and much more hesitant to buy anything for the windows.
Buy drapes.
I know.
You
it's weird.
You can return those though.
I hear you. I know it's not sensical, but it's what's happening in my brain.
Well. Okay. That's good then.
I'd like to take this off now.
All right. Let's go ahead and pause this. We will be back instantaneously for you.
Yes. BRB. Magically taking off his mask. We did it. Mine was easy. Nicole's was?
Easier than normal.
Easier than normal. Okay. So, mask taken off. Actually, Nicole, just you tell us about your experience and you can go ahead and do your rating.
Well... I thought it was a nice mask. I did. It was beautiful. It felt fine while it was on. It didn't get super, stiff when it was dry,
mm-hmm.
which I liked. I liked it. Like, it was so far the easiest peel off mask for me to get off my face.
Yes, I think we might have to step up the moisture game for you in advance.
Like previous, yeah.
Yeah, like you might have to like legitimately almost moisturize your face or maybe splash some water. I don't know. We'll ask Selena some opinions.
Well, yeah. Well, I don't know. We did the mist and maybe I just didn't do enough mist. I don't know. But overall, I think I would give this a B+, A-.
Okay.
Because my skin feels fine.
Mm-hmm.
Not fine. Like, it feels good. It looks nice. I don't notice a huge, like, jump in anything.
Mm-hmm.
But we literally just took it off. No. So I would B+, A-. Felt good. It was easy for me to take off. Easy enough for me to take off. Like,
yeah.
We all know my struggles. So what would you give it?
So I'm going to go with, I guess I'm a little conflicted. This might be harsh, but I was thinking a C. Now, I kind of echo you. It's fun. It was definitely like a good mask to do with someone. So it's a fun, like, girls' night activity.
Mm-hmm.
But for my skin, at least, like when I first took it off, my skin was a little red. So I feel like perhaps I left it on too long, but I feel like it might be a little too drying for me personally, you know, as someone with dry skin.
Yeah.
And which can also be slightly sensitive at times. So fair. I feel like it just may have been generally too harsh of a mask.
For you. Yeah. It's fine.
But mine came off really easily, so.
Well, aren't you special?
Which, at the same time, wouldn't you think that mine would have a hard time coming off and yours would be easy if I, you know, if it's like a dry skin moisture balance thing? But I don't know. I'm going to go see because my skin feels a little dry right now.
Okay.
I did appreciate the fact that it was a thin layer, so you really don't have to leave it on very long.
Hmm.
And there wasn't really a scent to it at all.
No.
So it's a pretty easy mask for anyone to do. You know, just like while you're doing your hair or whatnot, just beware if you have dry or sensitive skin.
All right. So on average, a B-.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can get behind that.
All right. Fair enough. Well, I don't have anything else.
No, I think let's wrap it up.
All right. Well, be sure to follow us on Instagram, or is it like our page on Instagram, and follow us on Facebook. I can't keep social media straight.
Follow us on Instagram.
Oh, okay, good. I was right. So follow us on all the socials, like our Facebook page, email us with any questions, show notes, show recommendations, massmurderpodcast@gmail.com. And that's all for this week.
Take care of yourselves.
Sources for this week include loc.gov, influencer.com, mayoclinic.org, mask.bar, performingsongwriter.com, sunsentinel.com, theavive.com, wikipedia.org, and Netflix's Remastered: The Two Killings of Sam Cooke.